Okay. Welcome everybody back. Wonderful to see and learn with you all. This is sadly the last class of the series of conversions and covenant, the halacha history and science of being Jewish. As I said last week, it's been so wonderful learning with you these past few months on this topic. I've definitely learned so much learning with you, and I'm very grateful, and I hope you enjoyed and found the material meaningful as well. Just a sort of a brief overview of what we're going to do today. As I mentioned last week, this is going to be a sort of a review shiur, a review class on what we've done. Obviously, I can't I can't condense about 2 months worth of material into an hour or a little bit less than an hour. And so what I want to do today is to go over the main points of each shiur. And then more importantly, I want to sort of just show how they connect together. Many of you might have been able to do that on your own, either consciously or unconsciously, but from in my experience, I've always found it very helpful to sort of explicitly put things together. It helps me organize the material in my mind, and hopefully you'll find it helpful as well. So we're not going to use any new source sheets. What I've done, let me see if I can find it. It's not here. I can't find it on the share screen. I made a source sheet. I combined all of the source sheets together so we can reference it. Oh, here it is. Let me see. Here it is. Okay. Yeah. So here, this is sort of the combined packet of pretty much everything we've done over the last 9 classes or so. If anybody wants this, I can email it to you after the class. So from the title is From People to Nation. The pasuk that I had at the bottom of the cover page is we discussed this in one of the classes. Va'atem tiyu li mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh eile hadvarim asher tedaber el bnei Yisrael. So Hashem is telling Moshe to encourage the Jewish people to accept the Torah. And he's saying this to tell the Bnei Yisrael, tell the children, tell the people of Israel, saying that if you accept the Torah, tehiyu li mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh, you will become more than just a mere people, mere children of Israel. You will become a nation. You will become a kingdom, both in the political sense, both in the national sense, or the sort of secular sense of the term. That the Jewish people only became a nation or a national entity with the acceptance of the Torah. But even more than that, in a spiritual sense, also the primary intent of God giving the Torah to the world, bestowing it upon the Jewish people, was not with individuals. It was not with 600,000 Jews. It was with one nation of Jews. And we truly became, and into that role, at Kabbalah Satorah, at receiving the Torah at Sinai. And that brings me to the sort of two main points, two main takeaways from this class. And each of those points has two sub-points. So in Mishnaic Hebrew, I guess the phrase would be Shtayim Shehein Arba, two that are actually four. The first main point, we'll call it 1A, is, as we just said, that contrary to either popular belief outside of the Jewish community, maybe some people even in the Jewish community, Avraham was not the first Jew. I remember when I was little, I had a Time magazine for kids almanac, and they had a section on religion. And when it talked about the Jews, it says that Abraham was the first Jew. So based on what we've learned, that's not true in the normative sense of the term. Avraham Avinu was not the first member of the Jewish nation. There was no first member. It was all 600,000 Jews at Har Sinai. That is the first main point, that the Jewish people really came into being at the time that the Torah was given. And the sort of two B, the second subpoint of that is why that's so significant, why that's so important. And as we'll see, as we've seen, and as we'll see later today, the main impact of God giving the Torah as being the nexus point and the genesis point of the Jewish nation is that our national identity is defined by the Torah in the sense of being commanded by God. It wasn't that the Jewish people only voluntarily accepted to do nice things for God. It was that God gave us the Torah in a sense of commandedness. And as we quoted from Rav Lichtenstein and from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that made the enterprise of Judaism a two-way street, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanding us and us fulfilling the command. We both invested, as it were, in this relationship, and we became, so to speak, extensions of God, being able to work in the image of God, being B'Tselem Elokim. We were able to transcend our mortal limitations and not only impact ourselves, but impact both in a physical and in a spiritual sense, the world around us. And that is why the Torah is the center point of the Jewish people. That's the first main point. The second main point is that despite the fact that the Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and their families, essentially the pre-Matan Torah Jews, as it were, even though they weren't Jews in the fullest sense, even though they weren't part of the current Jewish nation that we have today, they are nevertheless so integral to our national identity. Even though Avraham was not the first member of the Jewish nation, he is still Avraham Avinu, he is still Avraham our father, that we revere and we invoke to this very day. And that goes the same for Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, and all of the Shvatim. Even though they were not Jews in the same sense as we were, nevertheless, they have such a tremendous impact on and legacy on our nation for the rest of history. And the subpoint of that is also to be, if you will, the reason why. Why or what exactly did they give us? The reason why they're so special is because they had such a profound and intimate connection to God, and their only desire was to further God's divine plan for the world. Because that was so central to who they were, both in a spiritual sense as well as in a sociological sense, they passed on those character traits and that vision and that closeness to God in the Jews' spiritual DNA, which we have a havtacha, we have a promise from God, a bris, a covenant, that that will never go away. That connection that the Avos had to Hashem and the character traits that they exhibited because of that connection, that will endure for all of their children. They pass that on for the rest of history. And that actually serves as the vision that we have with God today. The Torah and mitzvos, Bris Sinai, the covenant of Sinai, those are the nitty-gritty rules and ways in which we can actualize the shared vision and dream that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov passed on to us. So those are the two major points. First major point, just to review, the first major point is that the Jewish nation really came into being at the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, which allowed us to impact the world around us and not just ourselves. And secondly, even though the people before that time were not Jews in the same sense as we were, nevertheless, the legacy of the pre-Matan Torah world is so fundamental to our identity because of the cultural and spiritual legacy that they passed on in the Jew's spiritual DNA for all history, that we are promised will endure forever. So let's now go into details. So the first way, going back to the first point, I'm trying to scroll here. Here we go. The first class that we had about the rights of man, if you will, Ramban and Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, Hakel Covenant and Political Theory, both that and the second class, really serve to open up the discussion of how we know that the Jewish nation really only started at the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai. And the main point that we took out from this first class was based on Rav Shlomo Fisher, who's the current Rosh Yeshiva of the Itri Yeshiva in Israel. He was bothered by two questions which the Jewish people have been struggling with for many, many generations. The first one is, why is normative halacha legally binding? Just to get into more specifics, later generations of Rabbanim are not allowed or do not argue in practice on earlier generations. A rabbi from the Gemara can't argue with a rabbi from a Mishnah. And nobody is allowed to argue with a Gemara. And yet we showed that that really isn't the strict halachic rules. In certain circumstances, a later court is not allowed to argue with an earlier court. But we proved from the Rambam, who says that if it comes to interpreting biblical verses using the rules of hermeneutics, the Rambam paskins, the Rambam says that you're allowed to if you think that you're more correct than the earlier generation. And yet, that does not seem to be the case with the vast majority of the Talmud being debates on these verses and certain ideas. Nevertheless, we cannot argue on the Talmud. And the question which many rabbis have struggled with is why? And the most basic answer that we could come up with was that we just decided not to. And yet that in itself is a very difficult question, is a very difficult idea to understand, because, well, maybe if we feel that we want to argue, maybe we should be able to argue with the Gemara. That's one phenomenon that Rav Fisher was bothered by. And the second phenomenon was much more philosophical, which is that two of the main critiques of Judaism from the outside world is that, it seems to be a very legalistic religion with a lot of loopholes, like selling chametz on Pesach and stuff like that. And the other critique that the nations of the world have is that religion, at least in the modern world, religion is supposed to be between humanity and God, not interpersonal. And yet Judaism seems to encompass a lot of interpersonal things. And the very fact that we can, when the Jewish people had political sovereignty, they were allowed to compel people to do mitzvos. And if religion is something that is between one's heart and God, why is forcing effective, and why is there a value? Why is there a utility in forcing people to do mitzvos? And why should we be allowed to do it? And so to all of these questions, Rav Shlomo Fisher developed an idea, which he said, let me scroll down to it. Here it is. He says, the Torah of the Jews has a character of mishpat, the foundation of which is the concept of covenant in the Torah. He says, first of all, the Torah, the way that that God gave the Torah to the Jewish people was in a legalistic manner, in a covenant. Why is that? Why did God want to do that? He explains that the Torah, the Holy Torah, is not a Torah for individuals, but a Torah of the community, the Jewish nation. This is indeed something wondrous, that an entire nation of men, women, children, wise people, and fools all together comprise a holy nation. And each Jew is one limb in the structure of Knesset Yisrael, God's divine presence. And this is the reason why all Jews are responsible for one another. And he says that the reason why there is this concept of Kabbalah Sarabim, of the entire Jewish community deciding to accept something upon themselves, why we can't argue on a previous generation, the reason why that covenant is binding for all eternity, is because, as he said in the name of the Ramban, that is how the Torah was given. The Torah at Sinai was given as a covenant. And any communal acceptance that happens subsequently is also binding for all future generations, just like the giving of the Torah was, for the same reason. Because the Torah was given to a community. And a community is an organic entity that transcends multiple generations. That's why we mentioned the Edmund Burke's response to Thomas Paine about a similar question. Why should laws that one generation accepted be binding on future generations? And he says the reason is because laws are not given to individuals. They're given to a society. And a society is a multi-generational enterprise. And so similarly, Lahavdil, for the Jewish nation and the mission of Yiddishkeit, it wasn't given to a Jew and then to the Jew's child. It was given to Am Yisrael. And therefore, Am Yisrael really became a nation with the giving of this Torah. Just one other proof that we mentioned in the second class, this was from the responsa of the Rogatchev Argon, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, when he talked about the Aliyah movement and why he was opposed to political Zionism. He says he was not opposed to people just making Aliyah, moving to the land of Israel. And he says the reason why is because even though he believed that there was a prohibition for the Jewish nation to move back to the land of Israel before the coming of Mashiach, he says an individual moving to the land of Israel does not mean that you're part of the Jewish people. It just means that you as an individual are deciding to do it. It's only if it's made as a political entity that he believed that that would sort of constitute an Am Yisrael moving to the land of Israel. Not getting into the politics of it, his proof for this idea stems from a medrash about Yosef. So Yosef made his descendants swear that they would bring up his body. And yet, it also says that he made his kids swear that they would make their kids swear. He essentially said that each generation has to impose a new oath on the subsequent generation that they would bring his body up. And the Rogatchever asked, why is that the case? We don't need to do that anymore. If we impose a shvua, if we impose a covenant, if we impose something on either a family or a community or the entire Jewish nation, we don't need to renew that covenant every generation. And the Rogatchever answers that that was only after the Jewish people became a community. He says in the response of the Tzafnas Panach, he says that was only before the Jewish people entered into the entity of a community and congregation. But afterwards, and after they entered into the land of Israel, they became a community and became one eternal entity. And so the Rogatchever says that there were two stages of the Jewish people becoming a nation. The first was the giving of the Torah, and the second was coming into the land of Israel. And so he says before that point, they were just a group of loosely affiliated, related individuals, but they were not a nation. That only changed when they gave the Torah. We brought another proof to this idea from Rav Soloveitchik in his famous lectures and book called Odi Dofeik. He says that the essence of Jewish fellowship on the level of the covenant of Sinai is a byproduct of the father-son relationship between the members of the nation and God. At Sinai, God transformed the people, an amalgam bereft of all direction and purpose, into a nation, a term that signifies a distinct communal profile. Just to sum up from Rav Shlomo Fischer, from the Rogatchever, and from Rav Soloveitchik, we have this idea that the Jewish people really only became a nation at the giving of the Torah. And if that's the case, the next question that we probed was, well, okay, what was the status of the people that lived before that? Were they Jewish? Were they not Jewish? What exactly were they? And what role do they play to this day? So specifically, the Avos were Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were they part of the Jewish people? Were they Jewish? And so to answer that question, or to begin exploring that question, we focused on their level of mitzvah observance, just as Jews nowadays are commanded because they're Jewish to keep mitzvos. Were the Avos obligated to keep mitzvos? Did Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and their families, did they need to keep mitzvos? Did they keep mitzvos? And the answer is that from the Torah itself, there really doesn't seem to be any indication of keeping mitzvos aside from circumcision. But Chazal, the rabbis, in multiple places in Talmudic literature and Midrashic literature say that they actually did fulfill mitzvos. The source for that is a pasuk in Bereishis. It says, Ekev asher shama Avraham bekoli. God is saying that I'm going to be good to Avraham because he listened to my voice. V'yishmor mishmarti mitzvosai v'chukosai v'sorosai. God kept my Avraham kept my charges, my commandments, my laws, and my Torah. And the Gemara says that it doesn't just mean bris milah, because then it wouldn't go through all of these repetitive phrases. Rather, it means that Avraham kept all of the mitzvot. And we proved from other midrashic sources, unlike what some argued, that it was only Avraham, that even Yitzchak and Yaakov and Yosef also kept a lot of mitzvot. Maybe not all of them, but they kept many, many mitzvot. So it would seem that the Yavos kept mitzvot just like the Jews did. And yet that brought up a host of questions. We highlighted three of them, three instances where the Avos seem to either do Averos or not fulfill mitzvos, and that would seem to contradict the Gemara and the other Midrashic literature that we've learned. The three examples that we gave were that Yaakov married two sisters, which is something that we don't do nowadays, something that's at least rabbinically prohibited. Another is that if you say that the Avos kept Shabbos, which there are many accounts that they did, if they weren't Jewish, if you hold that the Jewish people really were only the Jewish people once they were given the Torah, then the Avos should not have been allowed to keep Shabbos because a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. That's the second issue. And then the third is why Avraham waited to do circumcision. If Avraham knew, was able to derive all of the mitzvos, why did he wait to get a bris milah until God commanded him? Those were sort of the three cases that seemed to go against what the general rabbinic consensus is, that the Avos kept mitzvos. So let's address them one by one. So the first case is that Yaakov married two sisters, which might be a biblical prohibition or at the very least a rabbinic prohibition. So we gave a lot of different approaches. The first one, which I already mentioned, is that of the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserlin, who wrote the glosses to the Shulchan Aruch. He lived in the 1600s. He says that it was only Avraham. But all the other ones didn't keep any of the mitzvahs, except for circumcision. We proved from other rabbinic literature, from Midrashim, that that does not seem to be the consensus. Another possibility that's given is that of the Maharal, who said that the Avos, all of the Avos kept the mitzvos, but they only kept the mitzvos asei. Because mitzvos asei, positive commandments, are inherently good. Negative commandments, abstaining from things according to the Maharal, only has a utility if you're commanded to do that. If you refrain from doing something that nobody told you not to do, that's not a very positive thing. It's just sort of neutral. You could argue with that, but that's what the Maharal suggests. And we also proved from other Midrashim that that does not seem to be the case. The Maharal might argue on these Midrashim, but there are other Midrashim which seem to say that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov kept all of the mitzvahs, and not just the positive ones. The second approach, overall approach, that we give is that of the Ramban. The Ramban, in his Pirush al HaTorah, in his commentary to the Torah, was very focused on the land of Israel, said that we only really fulfill the mitzvos in the ideal sense in the land of Israel. And even though we're supposed to keep them outside of the land of Israel, when we're in exile, that's really only like practice that Hashem wants us to do until we get back to the land of Israel. And so therefore, Yaakov married two sisters when he was outside of the land of Israel. That's a different answer. A third answer that's given, this was given by the Prashas Drachim, is that they converted. That the Avos and all of their families converted to Judaism. And we have a rule that when you convert, you are no longer related to anybody. So therefore, when Rachel and Leah converted to Judaism, they weren't related, so Yaakov was allowed to marry them. We proved from the Ramban, though, that idea is not exactly, might not be so simple. That rule of essentially not being related to anybody might have only occurred after Matan Torah. So that's one potential wrinkle in the Parshas Drachim's approach. The fourth one, which is probably the simplest conceptually to understand, is that of the Rambam and his son, Reb Avram ben HaRambam. The Rambam in the Rambam in the Yad, in his commentary to the in his Halacha Sefer, the Yad HaChazaka, he talks about the different stages of the development of Torah, and he only mentions very few mitzvos. He mentioned that Avraham was commanded in the mitzvah of Bris Milah, that Yaakov was not allowed to eat the Gid Hanasha, the sciatic nerve. He doesn't mention any of these other things in the Gemara and in the Medrash. And his son, Reb Avram ben HaRambam, in his Pirish Al HaTorah, in his commentary to Bereishis, he says that the reason is that it's not meant to be literal. When it says that Yaakov put on tefillin, or that Avraham had matzah on Pesach, doesn't mean that they literally ate matzah or put on tefillin. What it means is that they did actions and exhibited character traits that were similar to the main point of what those mitzvos were. So yes, Avraham may have derived the mitzvos, but he didn't actually do them. He just kept ideas and he had practices that were in sync with the values of those mitzvos. That is the fourth approach. The fifth one, which we discussed in the next class, is what I call the mystical approach. And this is the one which we spent a lot of time on, because even if you might not believe that it's the correct one, it's very, very important in terms of our philosophy of mitzvos, as well as the broader understanding of what the avos were. The Rashba, and then later on, the Radvaz, and then even later than him, the Nefesh HaChayim, the student of the Vilna Gaon, all three of them have this basic idea that the avos, because of their great and profound connection to God and their sensitivity to the spiritual impact of mitzvos and averos, sometimes kept mitzvos and sometimes did not. They were able to understand the spiritual calculus of what happens when you do a mitzvah or an avera. And so it could very well be that even though normally when you do a mitzvah, that's a good thing, and when you do an avera, that's a bad thing, it's not always the case. It might be that at a certain point in time, for a certain person to do a specific thing, it might actually have a net benefit for doing an avera, and it might have a net cosmic loss for doing a mitzvah. That's why nowadays, or at least when we had Nevi'im, when we had prophets, we had the concept of a hora'as sha'ah, that a Navi, with the exception of permitting idolatry, was allowed to say that as a one-time exception, you are allowed to do any aveira in the Torah. Aside from idolatry, the Navi is allowed to say that God told me that he wants you to do this aveira. He wants you to eat treif. He wants you to marry a married woman, as that was one example that's given to Hosea, one of the Nevi'im, that God told him to marry somebody who he was forbidden to marry. Those things are one-time exceptions, and the rationale is that for every rule, there's an exception to the rule. Rules essentially say, listen, we're not able to give you a real-time answer for every single question that comes up in every single person's life at every single point in history. So we give you these general rules, but there may be an exception. And so the Avos, and Yaakov specifically, he knew, based on his very profound connection with God, that it would have a net spiritual benefit for the world if he married two sisters. So now, two qualifications for this idea which we spoke about. One is that it wasn't just that it wasn't just that Yaakov decided that he wanted to marry two sisters and then he rationalized it for himself. It was, as I said, because of his profound connection to God and his spiritual sensitivity that allowed him to make that calculation. And that sort of brought us to studying the whether the Avos were perfect or not. We mentioned a historical editorial from pre-war Europe. Let me pull it up. Let me see if I can pull it up. It was, here it is. It was a poem that was written by Itzik Manger, which seemed to critique Avraham for the callousness with which he, which we threw out Yishmael and Hagar from the house. And Rav Aaron Cutler wrote a very scathing editorial in a newspaper and then later gave it as a shmooze, saying that we should be very, very careful about how we approach and study and teach the Avos. They were so special, so perfect. Let me see if I can pull up his exact language. Here it is. He says, had there even been the slightest blemish with them, the entire existence of the Jewish nation would be radically different. Essentially, the Avos had no flaws. So some people understand that to mean that according to Rav Aaron Cutler and perhaps the general Haredi sentiment, that the Avos at least were perfect. And they contrast that with comments from other rabbis affiliated with perhaps more modern sensibilities like Rav Hirsch, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, where he does quote instances where Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov made mistakes. And he says that the Torah is, you know, does not do apologetics. We critique people when we believe that there's a utility in people learning from other people's mistakes. And what I argued is that Rav Aaron Cutler also agrees fundamentally that the Avos were not perfect. We mentioned several instances where even Chazal, even the rabbis, criticized Avraham. So the Ramban critiques Avraham for going down to Mitzrayim and jeopardizing Sarah because he lacked faith in God that he would protect him from the famine when Hashem told him to go to Israel. And I don't think that Rav Aaron Cutler would call the Ramban an apikores. What instead, I think the better way to read Rav Aaron Cutler's statement is not that they didn't make mistakes, but that they had no fundamental flaws. That's why he uses the lashon of pagam or a mum, a internal blemish, not whether you make mistakes. You can have a perfect, a fully functional machine that can still make a mistake. But rather, there was no fundamental flaw in the Avos' spiritual makeup. And we explain that that's what the Baal HaTanya, that's what the Kabbalistic Sfarim mean when they say that the Avos are the Merkava. There's a Medrash that says, Amar Reish Lakish said, Ha'avos hein hein ha-Merkava, that the Avos are a chariot to God. We explain from the Tanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, that what that meant is that the Avos, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were so intimately connected with God that just like a car has no inherent will, no inherent desires, no independent wants or needs, and its entire existence is to be a vehicle and to forward the agenda of the driver or of the person that's sitting in the car, so to the Avos, even though they were human, they had completely dedicated themselves to God's mission. They had no independent needs, no independent wants, no independent desires. It doesn't mean that they could have made a mistake. A car can malfunction. A chariot can malfunction. But it doesn't mean that it's inherently flawed. Avraham may have made a mistake. Yaakov may have made a mistake. Yitzchak may have made a mistake. But it wasn't because they had any internal character flaws. It didn't mean that they were self-serving in any sort of way. And that was what allowed them to make those spiritual calculations. Because they were a Merkava to God, the Rashba, the Radvaz, and the Nefesh HaChayim, they all said that's essentially why they were able to determine that in this particular scenario, namely marrying Rachel and Leah, that it's better for the entire Jewish people and the world if I marry these two people, even though it's an Avera. Now, the Nefesh HaChayim, just to go back, he introduces a second caveat, that this is the greatest proof that the Avos were not Jewish. He says that it doesn't mean that they were obligated to keep the mitzvos, because if they did, they could never even have used their understanding to rationalize transgression, even of a single part of a mitzvah. Meaning that once the Torah was given, nobody can use their own mind, even if they are a merkava to God, to say that, well, now the rules don't apply to me in this particular scenario because I'm so close to God and I know that he would want me to make an exception. That even though it might be a net spiritual loss, nevertheless, the will of God is such that you always have to follow the Torah. And even though theoretically there might be a net loss, it's actually a net spiritual gain simply because you're following the will of God, which has now transformed in the post-Sinai world to be the Torah as it was given to humanity and not the esoteric spiritual calculus that still exists in heaven. And just tying it to more timely matters in terms of Corona and davening with the minyan, we brought down we quoted a letter published by Rabbi Meir Tversky, who's a current Rosh Yeshiva in NYU. Let me see if I can find it. Here it is. He says, the quintessence of Torah then is acting in accordance with the Ratzon Hashem, God's will. And nowadays, after Sinai, no facet of Torah, be it Torah study, tefillah, or even love of God, possesses independent spiritual value and legitimacy per se. Before the giving of the Torah, it may have. And that's what legitimized Yaakov, according to this school of thought, marrying two sisters. But nowadays, the will of God has changed from esoteric values to what's written in the Torah that was given to humanity. The metric we use to evaluate the propriety of every action has to be whether it ultimately reflects the Ratzon Hashem as delineated by the halacha at a given time. And just to drive home the point, he says, even fasting on Yom Kippur and desisting from work on Shabbos are not, in an absolute sense, intrinsically sanctified spiritual modes. Before Matan Torah, that may have been somewhat different. Nowadays, though, that's not. In the service of God, there is only one factor, Ratzon Hashem. So before Matan Torah, the Ratzon Hashem, the will of God, was very case dependent. When there wasn't a canonized rule book, the will of God was just basically what is the net spiritual gain from doing this mitzvah or aveira. Nowadays, once the Torah was given and the Jewish people formed into a nation with the giving of the Torah, the sole expression of the will of God is what's written in the Torah. So that was the main, that was sort of how we dealt with that first question of how Yaakov could marry two sisters. The second question that we had was how the Avos were allowed to keep Shabbos if we know that that a guy who keeps Shabbos technically gets the death penalty. According to the Rambam, we don't actually kill him. Rather, he's Chayav Misa Bidei Shemaim. He deserves the death penalty from heaven. But regardless, how were the Avos allowed to keep Shabbos? And we brought the famous story about Warder Cresson, who was a former Quaker from America, who converted to Judaism in Israel in the 1840s. And while he had been circumcised, he hadn't gone to the mikvah. And there was a whole discussion of whether he was allowed to keep Shabbos or he had to violate Shabbos because he wasn't Jewish yet. And there was a whole discussion back and forth. And the consensus of most Rabbanim, unlike the actual rabbi who passed in the Shaila initially, the consensus of most Rabbanim is that he is allowed to keep Shabbos and he should not violate Shabbos because even though he's not a full-fledged Jew, nevertheless, he entered into the covenant of Mila. He essentially is in a state of limbo. He's a quasi-Jew. And the prohibition of keeping Shabbos is only for a full-fledged non-Jew because you're essentially infringing on the covenant of the Jewish people. But here, with Warder Cresson, he had actually entered into the covenant of the Jews. He hadn't fully finished it, but his Shabbos observance is not because he wants to keep Shabbos as a non-Jew, is that he's essentially following what the Jews do because he started becoming a Jew. And so that is another sort of way of looking at the status of the Avos. That is another way of looking at how we view the status of the forefathers, in that they're not fully fledged Jews, but they're not non-Jews. We quoted in the name of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, he says, "De'bechefza hayu aleihem shem Yisrael." In essence, they were Jews. "Ela de'bedin hayadin ben Noach." But legally, they were still Gentiles. So because Shabbos is tied to the essence of the Jewish people, therefore, Warder Cresson and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were allowed to keep Shabbos, because they were in essence Jews, they just weren't legally Jews. And Shabbos, because it's a covenant, is tied to the essence of the Jewish people. And that essentially goes into, adds another piece into the puzzle of how we look at the Avos. So far, what we know about the status of the Avos is that they were extremely close to God. They entered into a covenant with God. And so they became the essence of the Jewish people, but not the legal Jewish people. They were ethnically Jewish, but not religiously Jewish. And that distinction comes into play to help us understand that last paradigm of Bris Milah. The third question that we had, that the Avos kept the Torah, was how could, why did Avraham wait to circumcise himself if he knew that, if he knew it was a good thing? Why did he wait until Hashem told him to circumcise himself? And we gave two answers, which based on the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, we said are actually two sides of the same coin. One answer, which is given, it was given by the Panim Yafos, is that because these mitzvos were essentially done voluntarily, they weren't legally Jewish yet, you were only allowed to do things which didn't conflict with something that you were obligated to do. You can't volunteer to do something good if it comes at expense of something that's expected of you. So because it is forbidden for even a non-Jew to wound themselves, therefore Avraham was not allowed to wound himself through circumcision until God told him to. A second answer that we gave from the Mizrahi is that Avraham waited because Godol mitzuva ve'ose mimi she'eno mitzuva ve'ose. There's a concept which says that greater is somebody who fulfills a mitzvah because they're commanded than from somebody who fulfills a mitzvah just voluntarily. And we said that that's a little counterintuitive. I would have thought that it's better to essentially be doing something out of my own free will. It shows that I'm doing it because I want to and not just because the other person expects me to do it. And we explained based on, where is it? We explained from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who bases it on a ritva from Kiddushin, who says that placing at the center or even at the apex of our spiritual lives, the sense of being called and commanded. That when we say gadol mitzuva ve'ose, that greater is somebody who is commanded to do something than someone who volunteers to do it, it doesn't mean that it's worthless. If you volunteer to do something, it's good. And it shows that there's something that's special about you, that you want to give something to God or to somebody else. But nevertheless, the main notion, or the one of the primary principles of Judaism, the center of it, is the sense of being called and commanded. This is what religious existence in general is about, he says. The concept of mitzvah, literally commanded, presupposes an encounter between someone who issues a command and someone who receives it. This is one sense of the term mitzvah, the act and experience of God issuing the command and man absorbing it. That's what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein gave in a shir that's reprinted in By His Light. That's the name of the book, Characters and Values in the Service of God. What Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is explaining, we elaborated on, from a talk from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. who explains Kabbalistically, he says that before Matan Torah, based on a Medrash, before Matan Torah, because the Avos were not commanded to do things and only did things voluntarily, their impact on the rest of the world was limited. They were able to sanctify themselves, but they were not able to imbue the physical world with any additional kedusha, any other spirituality, because that's impossible for a finite physical human being to do. You can't imbue holiness by yourself into something that's physical. It's a contradiction. How can the infinite be contained in the finite? How can spiritual be contained in the physical? That's not something that's humanly possible to do. And therefore, as great as the Avos were, the only thing that they could perfect was themselves. What changed after Matan Torah, after the giving of the Torah, is that God commanded the Jewish people. God commanded the Jewish people to do things. And when we do mitzvos, not because we want to, but because God tells us to, we are in essence, as the Shem Mishmuel says, we are in essence acting as agents of God. And just like God is infinite and able to do whatever he wants, and he's not limited by physical constraints, he can imbue the physical world with spirituality, so too we. We can also imbue the spiritual world. We can imbue the physical world, rather, with spirituality. And that's what changed by Matan Torah. By God enshrining the Torah in legalistic terminology, it empowered the Jewish people that now you don't use your own spiritual calculus like the Avos did to marry two sisters or to do other things, but rather because now we're playing by the rules and we're essentially playing by the will of God, now you are essentially agents or extensions of God and can transcend our own physical limitations. We can imbue, when we shake a lulav, when we light Shabbos candles, we imbue those things with Kedusha. When we write a Sefer Torah, we imbue cowhide and wooden poles with Kedusha. And that's something that the Avos, with all of their greatness, could not do. And that is the primary vision that God had for the Jewish people. If that's the case, we come to the second part of the series, which is, well, if that's the case, then what is the point of the Avos? What exactly did they give to the Jewish people, to their descendants, for the rest of history? It seems like they were nice people, so God chose that. He said, okay, your kids, I'm going to give the Torah to. They're going to be my treasured people. But if that's the case, so we don't really have anything to do with them anymore. So why are they so special? And to answer that, we based as a model our idea on the family feuds from Harlan, Kentucky, which psychologists and historians said the reason why there was such a propensity in that region for family feuds was because of a cultural legacy that was passed on from their ancestors that was perpetuated because of environmental conditions. And we said that the same thing also happens with the Jewish people. We said from Rav Shlomo Fisher that there are two elements of Kedushas Yisrael. There are two aspects to what makes the Jewish people holy. He says that one is ethnic lineage, and the second is religion. At Matan Torah, we got the religious part. We became legally Jews. But the ethnic part, it didn't go away at Matan Torah, but rather it persisted. And that came from the Avos. Avraham, as Reb Chaim said, was in essence Jewish, but just not legally Jewish. And so therefore, all of the people before Matan Torah had that one aspect of Kedushas Yisrael. They had that one aspect of the holiness of the Jewish people. They were in essence Jewish, but they didn't have the legal Kedusha. They didn't have the mitzvah, the religious Kedusha that we got at Sinai. But that first element of Kedusha, the ethnic lineage, lasted and persists to this very day. And the reason why that's so important is because they passed on certain character traits. Rav Tzadok HaKohen says that the midos of the Jewish people, of rachmanim, of mercy, of baishanim, of modesty, and gomlei chasadim, of kindness, those are character traits that we inherited from the avos because of that, essentially, kedushas hageza, that ethnic kedusha that they passed on is not just the fact that we're related and they did good things so we have good things, but rather it were certain values and a shared sense of mission that they passed on from generation to generation. So much so that the you sort of have a mystical approach to this from the Tanya that says that that's why Jewish people have given up their lives for God. It's an irrational idea to give up life for faith. And he says, and even more so, he said, if our religious connection with God is proportional to how close we personally are in terms of how much we learn, then only the biggest Talmidei Chachamim in history should have given up their lives because they were the closest to God. But the Baal HaTanya says that if you look throughout history, that's just not the case. You have even the most simple people and even wicked people who don't even think about it. But when given the choice between denying God and giving up their lives, they have given up their lives. And we're going to remember these people in a few days, if the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, we're going to remember all of these tragic events during Kinos. That throughout history, even the most simple Jews have given up their lives. And even the most educated people, the Baal HaTanya says, if you would ask them why they're giving up their lives, they said it would not be out of intellectual conviction, but he said it would be second nature. It would be instinctual that you give up your life rather than renounce God. And he said that is what was passed down from the Avos. This spiritual legacy, this spiritual resource was passed down from the Avos. That's what it means when there's Kedushas Hageza, that there's sanctity of an ethnic connection to the Jewish people. And just parenthetically, there is a concept of conversion, that when a convert joins the Jewish people, they are joined into that Kedushas Hageza as well. They also become part of that. There's a Pintali Yid that's within each and every Jew, a Jewish spark that was passed down from generation to generation from the Avos because of their connection to God, because they were a Merkava, they were a chariot to God that allowed them to pass on those values and that mission for all future generations. And we finished off this idea of saying that that's what the concept of Bris Avos means. We spoke about Rav Eliyahu Dessler's approach during his distance learning shiur during the Blitzkrieg, where he talks about when we mention Bris Avos, when we mention the covenant that God made with the forefathers, that the Jewish people won't be destroyed, it doesn't mean, he says, that that's just simply because our ancestors were good so we get a free pass. There's no such thing as a free lunch in Judaism. Whatever we do, we earn. Rather, what Bris Avos means, he gave the example of when a judge is sentencing a wayward youth. The judge might be lenient if the person has a wholesome family environment, not because we just give him a free pass because the family is a good, famous, wealthy family, but it means that he has the resources to reform on his own than in the less ideal environment, like in jail. So too, the concept of Bris Avos, Rav Dessler says, is not that just because Avram was a good guy that we get a free pass. Rather, what it means is that we have this rich reservoir of spiritual heritage that we can tap into even if, God forbid, we stray from the path. Even the most wicked Jew, the Tanya says, is able to sacrifice their life for God because of that spark within them, that they just need to fan the flames a bit. That instinctiveness to get close to God is what Bris Avos means. It doesn't mean we get a free pass, but it means that God gives us another chance to tap into that resource because we have the ability to utilize it. And we finished off this topic with Rav Tzadok, who said that what it means that it's a covenant, that it can never be abrogated, is because essentially God has promised us that he will intervene throughout history to ensure that the connection, that cultural, spiritual connection that we have with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov will never be severed on an emotional, on a national level. That whenever the Jewish people, God forbid, are at risk of losing their connection to everything that the Avos stood and dreamed for and lived, God will intervene to make sure that that never happens. And therefore, we will always be able to tap into what the Avos bequeathed to us. And then finally, the last topic, which we spoke about these last 2 weeks, were how these two operate together, how these two covenants work together. We spoke about how the two covenants of the Avos and the covenant of Sinai parallel the two types of covenants that existed in the Middle East. One is a land grant, and the other is a political treaty. A political treaty has expectations on both sides, just like the covenant at Sinai. If we do the mitzvot, God rewards us. If we don't do the mitzvot, God punishes us. A land grant is a unilateral agreement where God says, I will give something to you whether you do something or not. And that, at least superficially, seems to parallel the covenant, that Hashem made with Avraham by the Bris Bein HaBesarim. Hashem said that I'm going to give you the land of Israel to your kids. But what we said is that while superficially there doesn't seem to be any strings attached, there is actually a conditional nature to it. Not a conditional nature of fulfilling specific mitzvos or averos, because as we saw earlier, the Avos were able to make a spiritual calculation and say, these mitzvos don't apply to me right now. Rather, it was the hein hein ha-merkava aspect. It was the, do these shared values and vision that you have, is it solely God or is it your own? And if it's solely God's, then you can get the land of Israel. God's plan, for whatever reason, was that the Jewish people needed to go down into slavery and then come back. If you wanted to be part of that mission and those values, you got the land of Israel. That was the conditional nature. It was a condition of values and not of particular actions. And so that is how we explained the relationship between these two covenants. The legacy of the Avos is not about particular mitzvos. It's not about being a nation in the religious sense of it, in the action sense of it, in the political sense of it, because that's not what the Avos were. They were a group of individuals. They were a family. But they were a family that was so intimately connected with God that they had no independent will. They had no independent desires or wants. God's dream was their dream. God's wants were their wants. And that was what they were able to pass on. They passed on that grand vision, which the Jewish people were able to tap into. What happened in the covenant of Sinai was that God enshrined that, you know, that abstract vision into concrete terms to how we could actuate it. And that is what the covenant of Sinai is. It is the individual actions that we do, the mitzvos that we do, the averos that we don't do, that enable us to tap into that general broad grand vision of the Avos of furthering God's plan in the world for bringing God and spirituality into the world. And we finished up, our time is up, so I just want to close with the very last thing that we spoke about, and that is the comment from the Baal Shem Tov. We discussed two main points up until now. One is that the Jewish people only became a nation at the time of the Torah, and the second is that the Avos bequeathed to us a spiritual legacy and vision that we tap into and complements our own personal divine, our own personal avodas Hashem of serving God. And the way that I think we can connect it in a very basic, in a very basic everyday sort of way is what the Baal Shem Tov finished up, is what the Baal Shem Tov said about what we say in Shmona Esrei. Elokeinu ve'elokei avoseinu, our God and the God of our fathers. And he says there are two ways that a person can connect to God. One is through their own exploration, and the other is through ancestral faith. And they both have pros and cons. Ancestral faith is limiting, but it's unshakable. Personal exploration is limitless, but it's also fraught with danger, and it's not a sure thing. And what the Baal Shem Tov says is that we need to combine both of them. We need to combine Bris Avos and Bris Sinai. We need to combine both of them to have a bedrock, an anchor of the spiritual character traits and vision that our ancestors had and passed down to us. And at the same time, we use our own personal exploration, our own personal Avodas Hashem, to channel that rich legacy that we were given. And so we find ourselves in the Bein HaMitzarim, the times between Shavasar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, when we mourn the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And as we opened up this series very 2 months ago, we spoke about Hakel, how the Jewish people came to the Beis HaMikdash once every 7 years to renew, as it were, that covenant with God. Men, women, children, everybody needed to gather in that courtyard. And the king, not the spiritual leader, but the political leader, that is, the Rambam says, is the heart of the Jewish nation, read the Torah and adjured the entire Jewish community to be faithful with God. And what that symbolizes is that the entire Jewish community, Judaism is not just a religion. Judaism is Mamleches Kohanim, a kingdom of priests, Vigoy Kadosh, and a holy nation. There are two elements to the sanctity of the Jewish people, religion and Geza, and ethnic identity. And without one of them fully manifested, the mission of the Jewish people is attenuated, it's diluted. And without being in the land of Israel, without having a Beis HaMikdash, not only are we missing out on the spiritual, but we're also missing out on the national identity. Both are curtailed, both are diluted. And if the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt in the next few days, we should take a few minutes to think about how central the Beis HaMikdash is, not just for karbanos, not just for offering sacrifices to God, but being the center point of our entire national identity. And in that merit, we should be able to tap into our Bris Avos, to be able to tap into the covenant of our forefathers and use that to channel and inspire our own personal forms of Avodas Hashem and ultimately merit the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So as I said last week, thank you so much for learning with me these past few weeks, these past few months. It's been a true pleasure. It's been wonderful. It's been inspiring. I've definitely learned so much, and I hope you have as well. So if anybody has any questions or comments, please feel free to share.
Hi, Rabbi. Are you planning on having any other classes?
No. So I think this is, I'll be part of the rotation for the Tisha B'Av Kinos, but otherwise we've finished for the summer.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you, on the Kinos, is there going to be everything by Zoom this Tisha B'Av?
So I believe, I think they're still ironing out the details. My sense is that the entire thing will be accessible over Zoom, though.
Baruch Hashem, because it's going to be so hot. Previous years, we were able to cover the Lincoln Square, but and spacing and everything. All right. Thank you. So everybody have an easy fast, and I'm looking forward to another class with this rabbi. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And yes, everybody should have a very easy and meaningful fast.
Wait, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to say, each time the time flew by, like today, it was unbelievably fast. It was terrific. And I love listening to your voice. And most of all, each time I leave, I'm prouder and prouder of being a Jew. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And Rabbi, thanks for the link for the recording. So they really useful.
Oh, my pleasure. And God willing, when I upload the last one and this one, I'll share them as well.
Okay, so now I'm looking for you on YU Torah. That's it. All right, everybody, stay well. I'm leaving the meeting.
Okay, be well. So I'm going to stop the share, and I will stop the recording as